This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Patient Man, written by Joy Ellis, performed by Richard Armitage. Chapter 1. It was a long time since D.I. Rowan Jackman and D.S. Marie Evans had left work this early. It was early May and the sunny afternoon showed every sign of continuing well into the evening. Marie was grinning broadly, like a truant schoolgirl. I can't believe I'm finally doing this.
If you don't, my mother will never stop nagging me. She's tenacious, always has been,
Jackman smiled. He had a great deal of love for his mother, who, after all, was the one responsible for his enduring fascination with horses. As long as a year ago, Harriet Jackman had asked Marie if she would like to try horse riding. Marie, an inveterate motorcyclist, had jumped at the idea. It offered the chance of a different kind of exhilarating ride. But life in the Fenland Constabulary was pretty frenetic, and it had got in the way. Now they were strolling down a dappled, tree-lined avenue, heading for the Jackman livery stables. Jackman noted the sun dancing on the pale green foliage of the silver birches and oaks. It gleamed and dazzled with an almost magical brilliance. How come he had never noticed this before? Was he just too busy? He was about to mention it to Marie when he saw her give a wave. Ahead of them, waiting at the gate, stood his mother, delight written over her face.
You made it at last!
Marie stepped up her pace, calling out a greeting. Jackman watched her, the sun lighting up her long chestnut-brown hair. He followed with a rare sense of contentment. It was quiet and warm, and two of his favourite people were happy to see each other. He let out a sigh. Peace was not something you often experienced at Salton-le-Fen police station.
Hi, Mum. Hope you've got some really feisty beast saddled up and ready. Mind you, if Marie rides a horse anywhere near as well as she rides that bike of hers, you'll never get rid of her.
She'll be very welcome. Get rid of her, indeed. Harriet beamed at him.
Hello, son. Are you ready for a nice evening ride?
Try and stop me.
Marie turned towards him.
I'm so looking forward to the...
A loud crack reverberated around the stable yard. Marie stopped mid-sentence, a look of utter shock on her face.
Marie?
For a few seconds, Jackman stood paralyzed, watching in horror as a scarlet stain spread across Marie's blouse. Then she slowly started to collapse. Galvanized, he caught her before she hit the ground and gently laid her down.
Marie? No, Marie! Dear God!
He was vaguely aware of his mother on her knees next to them, hands at her face, eyes wide in horror.
Call 999, Mum, now, ambulance!
He held Marie, begging her to please be all right. But he had seen that strange, empty look before. He knew what it meant. As his mother shouted directions to the emergency services, Marie's body went limp. Her head drooped to the side. He howled her name over and over, but she lay still. His eyes filled, but then, through the blur of tears, he saw her stir, very slightly. He looked up. At the far side of the stables, he saw a shape, the figure of a man. As he stared, the man held up a hand, waved at Jackman in a kind of salute, and melted away into the trees that surrounded the stables. The sun glinted for a moment on the dull metal of a rifle barrel. Jackman recognized him immediately. Still cradling Marie in his arms, he screamed out,
"Ashcroft! You bastard! I'll kill you for this!"
He looked back at her pale face.
Marie? Marie?
Darling, wake up, you're having a nightmare.
Laura pulled him towards her, held him tightly and whispered,
"It's all right. It's all right."
Sweat coated his face and stained his t-shirt.
Laura... Oh, Laura, was I dreaming?
I should say.
and shouting your head off. Lucky we have no near neighbours.
All he could see was the hole in Marie's chest, the red blood spreading across her white shirt. Jackman began to shiver.
Can you tell me what it was about?
He told Laura what he recalled, though it was already beginning to fade. What remained was the feeling of peace, the light dancing through the trees, and then Marie dying in his arms. The sight of that blood creeping insidiously across her white shirt would probably haunt him for years.
I wonder what caused that,
he murmured, leaning back against the pillows.
You know perfectly well.
Laura relaxed her hold on him, but kept his hand in hers.
Alistair Ashcroft, the elephant in the room. He's always present, day or night, awake or asleep. And what was the last report that landed on your desk before you left last night?
An attempted break-in at the Fenside Gun Club. Now I'm seeing the connection.
He shook his head, amazed at what the mind will do.
Add to that the fact that Ashcroft threatened all those closest to you, and it's all too clear where that nightmare came from.
I thought those dancing lights were a bit weird. I've seen beautiful sunlight before, but what I saw on the lane to the stables was more like fairy dust from a Disney movie. Blimey.
He gave a short, humorless laugh.
I find dreams a bit scary. I mean, they are so real.
I know. But the science behind them is interesting. I did a bit of research on them a few years back.
Laura yawned.
We can talk about it another time. Right now, do try to get another couple of hours' sleep. It's only 3:30, you know, you'll be shattered in the morning.
She slid down beneath the duvet and turned on her side. Jackman put an arm around her waist, seeking comfort. He closed his eyes, then opened them, afraid of the nightmare's return. The minutes ticked by.
This was stupid.
He'd had bad dreams often enough. They were inevitable in his line of work. But none had affected him as this one had. It was the shock he'd felt. It was so real. He watched the numbers on the bedside clock until, at 5, he slid out of bed and crept from the room while Laura slept on. In the pre-dawn silence, he made a pot of tea and sat down at the kitchen table. He kept telling himself that he was a rational person, someone who didn't believe in premonitions. If he hadn't felt so shaken, he would have laughed at himself, but right now, not even the sun, just starting to rise above the fen, could dispel the feeling of doom. Something bad was about to happen. With an impatient sigh, he stood up. He might as well grab a shower, have some breakfast and go into work early. Sitting here staring into space wouldn't help anything. What he needed now was noise, the hubbub of the CID room. Hopefully that would sort out his head. Jackman poured Laura a cup of tea and took it up to her. He left it on her bedside cabinet and quietly took some clothes from his wardrobe. The noise of the shower would probably wake her, but he didn't have the heart to do it himself. He stared down at her sleeping form and smiled. They had wondered if their living together would work. It was early days yet, but so far it seemed just right. His house at Mill Corner was a comfortable old-world conversion of the buildings attached to a disused windmill. Although the mill itself still stood, albeit now without its sails and distinctive onion-shaped top, it had been disused for years. Since Laura had moved in, Jackman had enlisted the expertise of an architect to design and renovate the tower, creating an office, consulting room and storage space for her to work from. For years now he had wanted to make something of the mill. It was an obligation. He was responsible for a heritage piece and should not leave it to rot. Even if it didn't work out between them, the mill would be a usable building again, rather than a desolate hulk towering over his home. The renovation work had been costly, but it was almost finished, and he knew it would be worth it.
What time is it?
Laura said, still sleepy.
Around 5:30, sweetheart. I didn't want to wake you, but I'm going in early today.
He stroked her hair.
There's tea here, but you don't have to be up yet, okay?
Laura smiled,
mouthed, "I love you," and drifted back into sleep. Jackman turned his thoughts to the day ahead. They had no big cases on the go, but his desk was groaning under a mountain of paperwork, and he needed to make a start on clearing it. Something major might suddenly hit them. He grunted in annoyance, knowing very well that something major meant Alistair Ashcroft coming back into their lives. Laura had said that Ashcroft was the elephant in the room. It was true. He was out there somewhere, biding his time before he struck again. The one that got away. The face of the wanted killer was everywhere. Every officer in the Fenland Constabulary knew that face like the back of their hand. Ashcroft had not cared whether they saw him or not. In fact, he wanted them to know him. He was cleverer than they were, or so he thought. But one day he would take a wrong step, just one, and Jackman and the team would be waiting for him. Well, not waiting. They weren't sitting on their hands. They were actively hunting him. Apart from flooding the county with his likeness, they had notified estate agents, letting agents and landlords, hotels, B&Bs, solicitors, local banks and the post office to stop him slipping back into the area unnoticed. They couldn't block all the holes, but they could make it as difficult as possible for him to move around freely. Jackman had heard a number of officers say these efforts were a waste of police time and money. After all, there was no guarantee that Ashcroft would ever set foot in the county again. Jackman and Marie knew differently. He had vowed to come back, and he would. Alistair Ashcroft was a man of infinite patience. He would return. They just did not know when. Jackman got dressed, looked in on the still-sleeping Laura, and tiptoed downstairs. He made some toast, and eating it, stepped out into a new day. Today, he intended to break the back of the remaining minor cases and finish those reports. For some reason, it was imperative that he do this without fail. Was it that awful dream, or just a general impatience? Despite his earlier dismissal of premonitions, he couldn't shake the feeling that soon they were going to be very busy indeed. Chapter 2. Marie walked into his office wearing a deep turquoise silk shirt. Jackman felt relief flooding through him. So much for his dream.
Good grief, Marie exclaimed. How long have you been in?
She stared at the pile of paperwork in his out tray.
Oh, a while.
You've been reading up on feng shui again, haven't you, sir? Clear your clutter and promote a tidy mind.
Marie grinned at him. Or is the super breathing down your neck for results?
Neither, actually. Just couldn't sleep. And this lot, he pointed to the paperwork, was haunting me.
He returned her grin.
How was the day off yesterday?
Brilliant, boss. Took the new bike for a spin. She handles amazingly.
Ah, this one's a girl, is it? How come?
Well, after Harvey was annihilated, I decided to try a new line, if you know what I mean. We went to Cromer, had the best crab lunch ever, and drove back before the traffic got too bad. It was the perfect day.
And her name? Asked Jackman.
Not sure yet, sir, but she'll tell me when she's ready. So I'm all refreshed and raring to get to work. What's first?
After a strong coffee and the morning meeting, you and I are going to visit a certain Mr. Kenneth Harcourt at a house named Wits End. How does that sound?
Wits End? Is he some kind of nutter?
Coffee sounds good, but I'm not too sure about someone who calls their house that.
Well, I hope he's no nutter, because he owns that private gun club out on Bartlett's Fen. Someone attempted to break into it yesterday.
What? The Fenside Gun Club? That's pretty snobby.
Marie raised her eyebrows.
Actually, very snobby indeed. So what happened?
Last night there was a break-in at his home. Most likely it was the same bunch of villains who'd failed to get into the club earlier that day.
Okay, I'll go and get those coffees and you can fill me in on what we know so far.
Jackman watched her leave, wishing he could shake off the remnants of his nightmare. That feeling of doom. It was like a film clip played on a loop in his head. It just wasn't like him to be so unsettled by a stupid dream.
He stacked the final reports in his out tray and heaved a sigh of relief. At least they were done. Now they could concentrate on the petty crimes, and hopefully in a couple of days they would see daylight. Marie returned with coffee, and he told her what Uniform had reported following their visit to the gun club and Kenneth Harcourt's home.
Whoever tried to get into the gun club underestimated the security they have there. The CCTV images show a couple of rough-looking scroats who obviously had little previous experience of breaking and entering. It's thought they were chancers who bit off more than they could chew. We've got some pretty good pictures, but no faces. As you can imagine, they were wearing the usual hoodies. Marie frowned.
But we have to assume that they were pretty desperate to get hold of a gun if they then turned their attention to Harcourt's private address. That doesn't sound like chances to me. How did they get hold of his home address in the first place?
He's well known. Has fingers in all sorts of pies, apparently. If I were after his address, I'd just follow him home when he left the club, no sweat.
Marie stared into her coffee, swirling it around like a fortune teller about to read the tea leaves. So did they get away with a gun?
Two, according to Uniform. Both have valid licenses. They've circulated the type, caliber, and serial numbers to all forces.
Just for a second, the final scene of the dream flashed through Jackman's mind.
Alistair Ashcroft waving to him from across his mother's stable yard, rifle in hand. I don't like the thought of firearms here in Salton Le Fen.
Me neither, boss, said Marie. Especially not in the hands of a couple of lowlives. Although they were probably stolen to order and are 100 miles away by now. Firearms fetch a high price on the black market.
That's what I'm hoping.
He glanced at his watch.
Let's get daily orders out of the way and then go and talk to Mr. Harcourt. As a shooting man, he should know better than to leave his guns where they can be stolen so easily. Doesn't he keep them in locked gun cabinets?
He had seen it far too often. The casual attitude to guns displayed by people who used them regularly, especially among the upper classes. He found them in wardrobes, in umbrella stands, propped up behind doors, and in the downstairs toilet and numerous other insecure places. Time after time people had said to him, "What's the use of a gun if you can't lay your hands on it quickly?" Jackman's father had taught both his sons to shoot at an early age, but although Jackman was a natural and far better than his brother, he'd never taken to it, especially hunting. Target shooting was fine, but as soon as he got a living creature in his sights, he faltered. But at least it had taught him a healthy respect for guns, even air rifles, which were religiously locked away after every use. The laws were in place for a very good reason. Jackman stood up.
Right, let's go. The quicker we can get the morning meeting done, the sooner we can go.
They turned into the long, straight driveway of Wits End. Situated on the outskirts of Salton Le Fen, it stood alone among miles of arable fields, which were now a sea of acid yellow rape, almost too bright to take in. The grounds covered perhaps 2 acres, part walled and part fenced, filled with all manner of trees and shrubs and carpeted with extensive lawns. Marie saw a small stable block and a greenhouse of Victorian design, the perfect country residence.
No comments about the house name, please, Evans, not the slightest giggle.
Jackman tried to look serious, but his eyes let him down. As if, sir, she said, all innocence. The house rose up in front of them, tall and elegant. The front door had a white-columned portico, and Marie could see heavy, lustrous drapes through the windows.
The whole place reeked of money.
It should be called something classy, not Wits Bloody End. She muttered.
I totally agree, said Jackman. It should be a Regency Lodge or perhaps an Enderby. Well, let's see what kind of man the owner of Wits End is.
They climbed out of the car and mounted the steps to the front door. Jackman rang the bell. They heard dogs barking and someone shouting. Well, at least they are home, Marie whispered to Jackman. Sounds like he's rounding up the hounds. The man who answered the door was tall and straight-backed, with a full head of greying hair, and looked every inch the county squire.
Ah, good, the detectives. Come in, come in. Marie and Jackman entered a spacious hall, sparsely but tastefully furnished, the walls adorned with a collection of beautifully framed hunting scenes that were definitely not prints. Harcourt led them through to a large, airy sitting room, where Marie got a closer look at those impressive drapes. The room had a lived-in feel. It was used, not merely kept as a showplace. Marie took a seat in a comfortable armchair and had a proper look at Harcourt. He looked familiar somehow, although she couldn't imagine where she might have seen him before. She was good at recalling faces, but she was struggling with this one. Jackman asked them exactly what had happened.
"From the beginning, sir. As I told the uniformed officers, we were all out, the whole family. I have a brother visiting from South Africa, and we went to the Red Lion for a celebratory dinner. The little bastards took an axe to the kitchen door, hacked off the lock, wrecked the blasted door."
Harcourt glowered at them.
"And before you ask, no, we didn't set the alarm before we left. We rarely use the alarm. Damn thing is so sensitive, a breath of wind sets it off."
"You have dogs, sir. We heard them when we arrived, didn't they bark?"
"Probably barked their heads off, but who's to hear them? As you can see, we have no nearby neighbours."
"The intruders didn't harm them?" Jackman asked.
"No, and they weren't put off by them either. The dogs were shut in the family room and the thieves didn't go in there."
"So, where were the guns taken from, sir?" Marie asked.
"My study. I have a couple of gun cabinets. One a steel shotgun safe with a digital keypad, and one that belonged to my father, an antique carved wooden one. That's the one they trashed. Used a bloody axe on it. Beautiful piece, irreplaceable both in design and personal value. Now it's matchwood. Your officers have already photographed it and gone over it for prints. What's left of it?"
"So they were all locked away?" asked Jackman.
"All bar one air pistol that my son uses. That's in a drawer beneath my desk. It's still there. It would have taken brains to work out the catch that releases the drawer, and these savages were evidently not well endowed in that department. It's an old desk, and the drawer has a secret compartment, especially made to house a service revolver. Not that we have one."
"Perhaps you'd be kind enough to show us later, sir?"
asked Jackman, more sympathetic now that he knew the guns had been locked away.
"Certainly, Detective Inspector."
Harcourt suddenly looked tired.
"I'm assuming you won't get them back."
"It's highly unlikely, Mr. Harcourt," Jackman said. "Stolen firearms are usually moved on very quickly."
He glanced down at his notebook.
"I see the guns stolen were a target shooting rifle and a shotgun."
"Yes, the shotgun is a Dixon and Son box lock ejector made in the 1930s, a family heirloom, like the cabinet. And the target shooter is an Anschutz Supermatch bolt-action rifle."
Marie frowned. "You had other guns in the cabinet, but they left those?"
Harcourt nodded. "Yes, funny that. They could have had another couple, and that's apart from those in the main steel cabinet. Not that an axe would be any match for that gun safe. But they just took those two, and some ammunition."
"Anything else taken or damaged, sir?"
"Not nothing, so I suppose I should be thankful for that. At least they didn't draw pictures on the walls in excrement."
"Very true, sir. Sounds like they knew exactly what they wanted."
Jackman paused.
"The other two guns, the ones they left behind, what were they?"
"Air rifles. Varmint guns."
"Sorry?" Marie said, puzzled by the unfamiliar expression.
"An American term. They're used to keep rodents and rabbits down. Basically, they are reliable small-caliber guns for pest control."
"So they only took a valuable shotgun and an expensive target rifle?" She was trying to work out why they would have been so selective. "Surely even the varmint guns would have had some value?"
"Not really. They come in at around £500 each.
Marie considered that plenty to spend on pest control.
"And the others?"
It took Harcourt a moment to respond.
"Well, my father's shotgun isn't worth a great deal. It had more sentimental value. I had it valued for insurance purposes about a year ago, and they said £2,500. The Anschutz is around £2,000.
She let out a low whistle. "Whew, and that's not a great deal?"
Harcourt laughed. "If they had been able to get into the other cabinet, it would have been a different matter."
A Purdy? Asked Jackman. Harcourt laughed louder.
Spot on. It's the jewel in the crown. But apart from that, I have my best target rifles in there. Walther's. And they're worth 4.5 each.
So how many guns do you own, sir?
Marie asked, having lost count.
Well, personal guns would be 9, including the pistol. We also have a small collection for general use in the armory at the gun club.
And every single one is legal and licensed? She asked.
Check for yourself, Detective Sergeant. You'll find all my guns are properly registered. And my gun club is hot as hell when issuing club firearms to members. The armourer is present at all times. They never leave his sight. Most of our members prefer to use their own firearms. We only offer ours if requested, usually to give visitors a feel for the club prior to joining.
Harcourt turned a hard gaze on her.
I take both the ownership and handling of weapons extremely seriously, DC Evans. I always have. I spent my early life in the military, so I know my guns. I also know what they can do.
Without taking his eyes off her, he rolled up his left sleeve and showed her an ugly scarred area on his forearm.
That wasn't the enemy, Detective. It was a friend of mine whose mind wasn't fully focused when he was cleaning his weapon. Something like that would instill a lifelong respect for lethal weapons, wouldn't you say?
Chastened, Marie nodded.
Absolutely, sir.
Clearly, there would be no Uzis in his umbrella stand.
Could we see the damage the thieves did, Mr. Harcourt, both to the door and the gun cabinet?
Harcourt stood up. Of course, come this way.
They followed him through the house to the kitchen door at the rear.
Not much finesse used on that, was there?
Jackman shook his head. Marie stared at the deep, ragged gouges and the splintered wood around the lock. It looked almost frenzied. A few well-placed blows could have done the job with far less damage.
A man is coming to fit a new door, Harcourt said, but the damage to the gun cabinet is irreparable.
He marched off back through the house, calling out over his shoulder.
Come, I'll show you.
Marie took careful stock of the house as they moved through it. It was a real family home, obviously well-loved. She passed several doors with brightly painted plaques on them. The children's rooms. Jack's room. Keep out. Kirsty's room. They entered a spacious study with double-aspect windows that looked out over the extensive gardens. The room was centered around a massive antique banker's desk that put Jackman's beloved office desk to shame. Marie almost laughed.
Wow, that's a statement piece,
he whispered reverently.
Jackman had obviously fallen totally in love with that desk.
So was that.
Harcourt pointed angrily to what remained of the gun cabinet. Even Marie could appreciate why he was so upset. The ornately carved wood had been hacked at and chopped up like kindling. As with the kitchen door, a huge amount of force had been used.
Using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, she murmured.
Precisely, growled Harcourt. And I'd like to use some of the same tactics on them, the bastards.
Jackman said nothing and just stared at the wreckage that had once been an elegant piece of furniture. Marie found it almost embarrassing to see this man so distraught about losing his father's precious belongings. She felt like she was intruding. She gazed at the rest of the room. Nice stuff, classy, but once again, well used. There was dog hair on the seat of a winged armchair by one of the windows, and a closer look showed dust and the odd stain on the carpet that looked suspiciously like the remnants of children's wax crayons. Then she looked at the glorious desk again, saw the leather letter racks and matching pen holders. It wasn't all museum pieces, though. At one end stood a laptop and a dock for a mobile phone, and a rather lovely modern woodblock photo frame. Marie almost gasped. One look at the picture instantly brought realization of why she recognized Kenneth Harcourt. The photo showed a young girl wearing the red and yellow football strip of Sultan Lefen Junior's football club. She was clasping a ball under her arm and looking directly at the camera lens. Kirsty Harcourt, 11-year-old girl, killed in a hit-and-run the year before. The car had been stolen and the driver had got away. There had been suspects, but no evidence that would hold up in court, and the coroner had found an open verdict. Not the kind of thing that gave closure to a grieving family. Kirsty's room. The plaque was still on the door. Marie backed away from the desk, hoping that Harcourt hadn't noticed her staring at the photo.
I think we need to get back and get some inquiries underway, sir, don't you?
Evidently puzzled by her sudden desire to leave, Jackman said, Yes, we do. Thank you for your time, sir. We'll keep in touch. Outside in the car, she told Jackman what she had seen.
Of course. Why didn't we recognize that surname? Jackman exclaimed. It was all over the papers for weeks.
They always just referred to her as Kirsty, didn't they?
Marie said.
Kirsty the WizKid footballer?
And it didn't happen on our patch either. She had been at a friend's place over Greenborough way, hadn't she? Marie nodded.
That's right. D.I. Nicky Galina handled it. It wasn't our case.
Jackman looked pensive.
Not that this break-in will be connected, but I wish I'd realized before we spoke to the poor guy.
Marie felt the same. She hoped Harcourt hadn't thought she and Jackman not mentioning it showed insensitivity, that they were dismissive of his family's tragedy. She turned on the engine, but didn't yet pull away.
Sir, did you notice that Harcourt hesitated when I asked him how many guns he owned?
Jackman shrugged.
Not especially. He does have a lot of them. It's not surprising that he had to think about it.
I guess so. But forget it, you're probably right. I just had an odd feeling that he was being, well, very careful as to how he answered.
Jackman smiled at her.
Hold that thought, Marie. You and your intuition, it's rarely wrong.
We'll see. Tell me, Mr. Knowledgeable, how much is a Purdy worth?
Jackman rolled his eyes at her.
My father told me this. Would you believe over 130 grand?
What?
Marie exclaimed.
How much?
And Purdy's aside, a Peter Hoffer sidelock can cost a cool million.
For a bloody gun?
She tried to imagine what she would do with £1 million. Buying a shotgun certainly didn't feature.
They are works of art, Marie. They have the most intricate engraving on the handle. Some take years to make.
I guess so, but it's still a gun, isn't it? Not a life support machine or a cancer research laboratory. £1 million could save hundreds of lives by supplying clean water to African villages. All a gun does is kill things.
I gather you won't be purchasing one if you win on Euro Millions, said Jackman.
Dead bloody right I won't. I hate the things. I've seen what they can do to people.
Marie glanced across to Jackman and saw an odd look on his face. She was about to ask him what was wrong, but when she looked again, he seemed his normal self.
Maybe she'd imagined it.
No doubt Jackman was recalling a particularly bad case he dealt with where someone got shot, or, more likely, he was reliving the time he was shot himself. Sometimes Marie wished she wasn't so sensitive to tiny nuances in people's demeanour. Like that hesitation of Harcourt's when he was telling her about his guns. Yes, maybe it was simple hesitation, but Marie had seen cogs turning and sensed the tension emanate from the man. As soon as she got back to the station, she would check out those guns and their licenses. Otherwise, it would keep bugging her. Jackman was staring out of the window. They were only minutes from town, but the Fenland farming area swept right up to the outskirts of Salton itself.
I wonder why such force was used, he mused. You hit the nail on the head when you described it as using a sledgehammer to crack a nut.
What was all that about?
That bothers me too, boss. I mean, if they did it because they hated the Harcourts and wanted to wreak mega damage, they wouldn't stop with just those two items, would they? They'd have smashed the whole place up.
Exactly.
Marie slowed as they entered Salton Le Fen.
One thing is for sure, they aren't professional thieves.
And they aren't crackheads looking for something to sell for drug money, or they'd have taken anything that they could lay their hands on,
Jackman added.
So what are they? She said.
I have no idea, Marie, and that bothers me. I like simple and straightforward, not convoluted and tortuous.
If I knew what that meant, I'd probably agree with you.
She stopped at a red light. What's clear is this. They wanted guns, or they would never have tried to get into Fenside Gun Club, and then when that failed, Harcourt's home. But they only took two. Why leave those other two? Even decent air rifles are worth something. Why not just take all four? Jackman asked. I thought this was a simple break-in. Now I'm well confused, Marie said.
And you're not alone.
Jackman scratched his head.
Let's just get back and see how the others are doing with the petty crime cases. Then maybe we can have a campfire. See what they think of our baffling theft.
Good idea, boss.
They drove the rest of the way in silence, each lost in thoughts of lethal weapons. Chapter 3 Robbie Melton opened the boot of his car and took out a pair of Wellington boots. He had been caught out wearing inadequate footwear when called to investigations in farmyards before. As he pulled them on, he saw the farmer hurrying towards him.
Frank Beaton, I'm DC Robbie Melton.
Thanks for coming out, officer.
Tall and thin, the man was dressed in many pocketed brown work trousers and an old faded jumper, under a worn and weathered gilet.
Let me show you where the pigs were stolen from.
How many did you say were taken?
Asked Robbie, looking around at the rather ramshackle farm buildings. The farmer and his small estate looked to be in the same condition, tired and overworked.
Six, and the rest of them were left wandering about the enclosure. I reckon they drove something pretty big at the fencing and just crashed through it.
Frank Beaton rubbed the back of his hand across his forehead.
Funny, though. They tried to drag the damaged fencing back into place before they left, can't think why.
Were you here when it happened, sir?
Asked Robbie.
No, it was our night for going to the comrades.
He must have noticed Robbie's blank expression and added,
The old comrades is a social club in the town. I takes the wife out, and we have a bit of supper there once a week. That night both my sons came too for a darts match, so there was no one here.
Meaning they knew the place would be empty?
Seems that way. We've been going to the comrades on a Friday night for years, it's no secret.
Robbie made a few notes in his book.
Were the pigs valuable, sir?
Depends what you mean by valuable. They weren't fancy breeds, just good wholesome stock. Four boars, one sow and one gilt.
Gilt?
Female pig that hasn't had any piglets yet.
Frank smiled at Robbie.
City boy, are you?
Not really, just not well up on pigs. Call me pig ignorant if you like.
Frank laughed.
I see. Well, I suppose they were worth around 500 for the six of them. They were all ear-tagged with our herd number.
Robbie had a feeling Defra's compulsory tags wouldn't be of too much use. He was pretty sure that these pigs had not been stolen to be sold on, but to stock a freezer.
Has anything like this ever happened before, Mr. Beaton?
Never in all the years we've been here, and that's quite a few, I can tell you. My kids were born here, and now they work alongside me.
He frowned.
Leaves a bad taste in your mouth, this sort of thing.
Robbie agreed. He tried to match the farmer's stride as he headed for the pig enclosure. Unlike the rest of the place, this area was well looked after. The animals had a large pasture with several farrowing arcs and field shelters, and a smaller enclosure with a low barn-like structure as well. There were big water troughs and sectioned feed troughs, and some very happy pigs rooting and wallowing in the field.
Over here, look!
Frank Beaton pointed to some hastily repaired fencing.
I reckon they drove it down, then turned around and backed a trailer in.
On closer inspection, Robbie was inclined to agree.
A 4x4 or a Land Rover, with a small livestock trailer, I'd guess.
He pulled out his phone and took a couple of close-ups of the tyre tracks. This kind of theft didn't warrant forensics, but if he could get an identification of the vehicle used, it would help a lot. Frank glowered at the damage.
I hope this isn't the start of a spate of this kind of thing, officer. I'm sure to some it's just a few head of livestock, but we've reared those pigs and we really try to do a good job with the welfare, sometimes to our own detriment. This kind of thieving is bloody unkind. I'm hoping this was a one-off, sir. I can see how you care for these pigs. They look really contented. But if anything else does happen, ring us immediately. Now you're on our radar, we'll do our best to keep a lookout, but to be honest... Frank finished off the sentence.
You've got bigger fish to fry.
It's the cutbacks, and the size of our budget, sir. But as I say... Robbie handed the man his card. Ring me direct. I'll be sure to get a car out to you. He felt for the man. This was no wealthy landowner or gentleman farmer. Frank Beaton was just a family man, a grafter who cared about his beasts. Perhaps you'd ring me if you hear of this happening to anyone else in the area. Not everyone reports this sort of thing. Frank Beaton nodded.
And I'll make sure the news gets around to the other small farmers in the area.
Good idea. Robbie changed back into his shoes and packed his boots away, wondering about the theft. Even the smallest livestock trailer would safely carry far more than 6 pigs. Why stop there? He didn't think they had been disturbed. Apparently the Beatons hadn't got home until sometime after the theft took place. So why just take 6? All the way back to the station, he couldn't shake off the idea that this figure was in some way significant. DC Charlie Button had been to some odd shouts in his short time as a detective, but this one took the biscuit. The theft of oil in farming communities was nothing new. Even in the villages, domestic heating oil tanks were regularly being targeted. Because they are pretty unsightly, many homes off the mains gas grid tried to hide their tanks away from the house and out of sight, perfect for thieves. Cases of oil theft were on the rise. This was different, though. This was red diesel. On the edge of the yard at Dewsbury End Farm was a large oxide oil tank painted red. It was used to store the diesel for the tractors and other farm vehicles. Charlie knew the law regarding this low-tax oil. It was called red because of the dye put in to prevent it being used in road-going vehicles.
Flippin' heck!
Charlie stood with his hands on his hips and surveyed the mess.
What on earth happened here?
Len Dewsbury shook his head.
Bloody idiots! He looked down.
Careful where you walk. My lads have done their best to clean it up, but it'll get on your shoes and you'll stink for days.
Charlie surveyed the large pool of sludge surrounding the base of the tank.
When we saw what had happened, we dug a trench to stop the spill spreading into the watercourse.
The farmer gestured towards a deep ditch that ran alongside the entrance to the yard.
Then we covered what was on the concrete in sand and soil to try to absorb it. We need to leave it overnight, and then hopefully we can sweep it up.
What do you think happened?
Asked Charlie.
A bungled attempt to steal diesel. We found a discarded hose, so they must have siphoned a fair bit off into cans. Then the silly sods couldn't stop the flow. If my son hadn't heard something and come out, the whole bloody tank would have drained out. This storage tank holds 500 gallons when it's full. Can you imagine the damage that would have done?
Len Dewsbury shook his head and let out an exasperated sigh.
Whoever did this was no pro, just an incompetent prat.
Charlie nodded.
Have you got that hose, sir?
It's over by the gate. But if you're thinking of saliva or prints, it was left floating in the oil, so you get nothing from that, detective.
Charlie was starting to feel nauseous from the smell of diesel, and was rather glad he wouldn't have to bag the hose and take it with him. He took down as many details as he could, then beat a hasty retreat to his car. No way would he find any other evidence. The whole scene had been trashed, first by the thieves and then the farm workers who had prevented the leakage contaminating the ditches. It was very doubtful that they would catch the thieves, and anyway, since they had made such a glorious cock-up of this job, it was doubtful they'd try that sort of theft again. Then the thought of that siphoning hose began to bother him. Like it or not, it was evidence, and as such he should bag it and tag it and take it back with him. If they did find a suspect, a piece of hose from his garage or garden could be matched up quite easily. With a resigned sigh, Charlie got out of the car and took an evidence bag from the boot. He pulled on a pair of nitrile gloves and went back to retrieve the hosepipe. Oh well, the stink was already up his nose. What was another 15 minutes breathing in the cloying stench of diesel?
Back at the station, Charlie told Jackman about the bodge job at Dewsbury End Farm.
I've suggested security cameras, sir. If they'd had them last night, I'm pretty certain they would have got some interesting pictures. Probably like something from a Laurel and Hardy film.
Jackson listened, frowning. What is it with all these petty crimes being carried out by blundering amateurs? The frown deepened. Kids?
Or maybe a gang of wannabe crooks, learning the ropes the hard way? Charlie suggested. Whatever, they made a right dog's dinner of this little caper.
Red diesel, you say? Asked Jackman thoughtfully. Would they dare use it in a road vehicle, I wonder? If they got pulled over, they'd get their collars felt for that.
I checked it out, sir. They could have the vehicle seized and they'd have to pay a fee for its release, plus the duty owed.
And if we've proved they nicked it, a fine and a prison sentence of up to 2 years hardly worth it, is it? Jackman added.
It can be used for machinery, as well as tractors and diggers and the like. So maybe they live on a farm, Charlie suggested.
Good point. Bear that in mind if we get anything else along these lines. The boss grinned at him. By the way, Charlie, you stink.
Thanks for that, sir. I had noticed.
As soon as everyone was back at base, Jackman called the team together to tell them what they knew about the gun theft. This was an unofficial campfire discussion, so they gathered in his office. They were all there. Marie, Robbie and Charlie, along with PC Gary Pritchard and DC Rosie Cohen. He smiled to himself. He still wanted to call her Rosie McKeldry, and he struggled to get his head around the fact that the young detective was now married to the one absent member of his team, Max Cohen. Max and Rosie were taking responsibility for their baby twins seriously, and so far had just about managed to juggle their shifts, leave, and days off satisfactorily. It was an arrangement full of compromises. Both were dedicated police officers, and neither wanted a lesser role in the team. But their children came first, and somehow, with the help of their combined families, they had made it work.
I hate to feel perplexed by the small stuff, Jackman grumbled. And right now I can't help worrying about the theft of those guns. It's just not straightforward.
Me too, Robbie said. Over 6 bloody pigs. And I still can't stop thinking about Kenneth Harcourt's manner when I asked him how many guns he owned. Stupid, but it's doing my head in. Oh, sorry, sir.
Marie pulled her phone from her pocket and stared at it.
A text. Can I check it, boss?
Jackman nodded, still wondering if he were making something out of nothing.
Sir?
Marie's voice shook. He took the phone from her outstretched hand and looked at the message. Forever in my thoughts. He stared at the attached photograph. His mouth went dry. It was a shot of himself, with Marie at his side, on the steps of the police station. He closed his eyes for a second.
Alistair Ashcroft?
Asked Robbie softly.
That is his favourite method of communicating, isn't it?
Jackman looked at Marie, and they nodded. They had known he would be back. But receiving actual confirmation made Jackman's blood turn to ice.
He was here, right here, outside the station, watching us, Murray whispered. CCTV?
Asked Charlie immediately. Jackman stared at the picture. From what they were wearing, it was taken some time ago.
I'm thinking this was taken maybe 8 or 10 weeks ago. We only keep the footage for 28 days. I'm afraid he's cleverer than that, Charlie.
Marie had begun to pace around.
Why haven't we had a single sighting of him if he's been hanging around for months? He's never been shy of smiling for the camera. Uniform have his face etched into their memory banks, but no one has seen a hide nor hair of him.
She glared at Jackman, her expression a mix of anger and trepidation.
We are in his sights again, aren't we?
With a calmness he didn't feel, Jackman said,
We were never out of them.
Alistair Ashcroft had always professed to be a patient man. He had taken that photograph but waited 2 months before showing his hand. Jackman wondered how long he had been watching them, from the shadows, and why he had chosen this particular moment to bring himself to their attention.
I guess checking out the sender's phone will be a complete waste of time, but I suppose I should do it anyway, said Robbie.
He held out his hand to Marie, who handed him her mobile.
As you say, it will be pointless, but nevertheless...
Marie flopped down into a chair and watched Robbie leave the room.
Here we go again, cat-and-mouse games.
She was right. Privately, Jackman wondered at the man's audacity in walking among them unnoticed. Now they were all in a state of high alert, but Ashcroft would have known this when he sent the photograph. He could well melt away again for another month, leaving them to stew. Ashcroft might have the patience of Job, but Jackman did not.
"What more can we do to find him?" asked Gary helplessly. "I'm no pessimist, but it seems to me that we've exhausted every avenue. We've had the whole town looking out for him for months, resulting in Sweet Fanny Adams."
"I hate to say it," chipped in Rosie, "but unless we get a stroke of good fortune, which is very unlikely, we're going to have to let him make the first move."
"Which could mean someone losing their life," Jackman concluded. "Not an option."
He had to act. It was time they got out onto the streets themselves. Someone out there knew something about Ashcroft. Maybe that person was hiding him. He knew he might be making the team into sitting targets, but that was a risk they were going to have to take.
"Look, guys, I can't dither around waiting for the hammer to fall. Let's tie up these annoying petty crimes and get out there ourselves."
He turned his attention to Rosie.
"With the exception of you, Flower, I want you to run the show from here."
Rosie opened her mouth to protest, but then closed it again. She had two new lives to consider. Her priorities had to be different now, and Jackman recognized that.
"I know it's not what you want to hear, but I need a solid anchor in the office, collating and chasing up anything and everything that we might uncover, no matter how small. You can do that standing on your head, and bloody well."
"You don't have to over-egg the pudding, boss. I get the drift."
Rosie pulled a face.
"But don't forget, I'm still a police officer, not just a new mum. And we all have to face danger every day that we show up for work. Both Max and I are fully aware of that."
"So am I, Rosie. But can we run with this for a while? I won't wrap you in cotton wool, I promise, but right now I'd like to know the ship is in safe hands while I'm running around like a headless chicken, okay?"
Her expression softened.
"You're the boss, sir. But somehow I can't see you doing the chicken bit. You're far too organized."
He wished he felt organized. Right now, he had no idea where to start.
"What about the gun theft?" asked Marie.
"Life goes on, even if Ashcroft has started playing silly buggers again."
He was pleased to hear a little of the old Marie. Receiving that text must have been one huge shock.
"You and I will get straight onto that, although by now those guns are probably long gone from the county."
He glanced at Charlie.
"Get the report done on your oil spill and pass it down the line. We have more important things to worry about than idiots nicking diesel and trying to ruin the ecology of Dewsbury End Farm."
He looked up as a glum Robbie came back in.
"As we guessed, unregistered phone and SIM.
Ron in IT said he reckoned it was a proper burner phone, bought anonymously, used once, wiped free of prints and then thrown away."
He handed Marie back her mobile.
"End of story."
"Okay, Robbie. No more than we expected. I was just saying that we'll tie up all the loose ends and go hunting. So can you sort out the paperwork on your piggy thefts, then report to me, okay?"
Jackman looked at the worried faces surrounding him.
"Think of it this way. This is day one of the investigation that will see an end to Alistair Ashcroft. So cheer up and let's get on with what we do best. He won't win. He's had his moment of glory, but it won't happen again. This time, we bring him down."
It wasn't exactly a rallying cry, but he did see determination on the faces of his team. It would do for now.
Chapter 4.
He was so deep in thought that he didn't notice the priest until he spoke.
You look troubled, my son.
Troubled? Hardly. It was all Alistair Ashcroft could do to stifle a laugh.
No, father. My heart is full of joy.
Then I'm happy for you. I'm afraid very few of my congregation could say the same.
Ashcroft shrugged.
Then maybe they are not following the right path.
And do you believe that you are?
Oh, yes. I know what path I have to tread.
He wished the man would go away. He was here for peace and solitude, not for a bloody sermon. What was that quotation? Who will rid me of this turbulent priest? Maybe a modern-day William de Tracy would arrive and slay this troublesome cleric. Sadly, he failed to materialize.
I was just on my way to the confessional. Maybe you...
The priest looked at him expectantly.
No, thank you, father. I confessed my sins this morning in St. Barnabas in Greenborough.
The priest stepped back.
Then I'll leave you to your reveries. God bless you, my son.
He bowed his head as if in prayer, waiting for the man to take the hint and leave him alone. After a while, he heard his footsteps fade away and the sound of a door closing. He wondered what the holy man would have thought if he'd made his confession and told him what was really on his mind. A small chuckle escaped his lips. He needed these safe places, quiet refuges from the chaos of the world. It might be a church, or sometimes he visited the lonelier spots out on the marsh at night. He sought them out at times when he needed to calm the inner voices, when they threatened to overwhelm him. There were times when they screamed at him like banshees, demanding to be heard, urging him to act, goading him on to right past wrongs. He breathed in slowly, slowly exhaled. To right wrongs. To seek justice for the ones who had no voice of their own. Those who had gone before, and one in particular. He stared up into the high-vaulted ceiling, breathed again. He had indeed found justice, brought restitution for the dead. He had accused, tried, and executed. But he found it hadn't been enough. The path continued to unfold before him. What had he said to that priest? I know what path I have to tread. No longer was he driven by a desire for vengeance, a need to bring about justice. His crusade was over. But it had left him with the certain knowledge that he was like no other killer on earth. No one else could have achieved what he had done. Now he could relax and indulge himself. It was time to play. Had he played games as a child? He couldn't remember. Well, now he was about to embark on the game of his life. The board was set out, the opponents chosen. Did they have any idea what was at stake? Alistair Ashcroft stood up. Let the fun begin.
Sarge? Gary stood beside Marie's desk and looked down at her. I've been thinking.
Careful, Gary, Marie winked at him.
Seriously, I was wondering if you'd like your old lodger back for a while.
Marie sat back in her chair.
Have your curtain-twitching neighbours finally got too much for you?
He shook his head.
The neighbours are no problem, but with a certain psycho on the loose, your being alone is a problem.
A while back, Gary had stayed in Marie's guest room in order to avoid a long commute while he looked for a new place in Salton-le-Fen. They had both enjoyed the experience, largely because of Gary's love of cooking and Marie's enjoyment of the results.
That's very thoughtful of you, Gary, but I'm fine, really, and you love your home in the village. We aren't far away from each other, and if anything happens, I'll ring you like a shot, believe me.
After all, their patient man could leave it months before he contacted them again.
Well, the offer's there, and I suggest that if we have the slightest suspicion that he's about to make a move, you think seriously about it.
Gary gave her a look of such concern that Marie felt a rush of affection for him.
I will, my friend. Don't you worry about that.
He hesitated for a moment before returning to his desk.
To be honest, Sarge, I'm with the boss on this. I think Ashcroft's finally ready to roll.
Marie sighed.
Deep down, she agreed, but was reluctant to admit it. Ashcroft had hurt her, physically and mentally, and even though she was recovered, she wasn't exactly enthusiastic about a repeat performance.
"Me too," she said softly,
"but I'm not going to curl up in my shell or quake in my boots. As the boss said, if he shows himself, we'll get him. We must. If he starts again, no one will be safe."
"Too right." Gary straightened up.
"Now, can I help you with your gun theft? I've tied up what I was doing, and I'm free to lend a hand if you like."
"Perfect."
She handed him a sheaf of papers. "Would you check out our Mr. Harcourt's gun licenses for me? Make sure his collection is all kosher and accounted for."
"Consider it done."
Watching him return to his workstation, Marie was struck by a sudden emotion. This team meant so much to her. She would be devastated if something happened to any one of them. And while Ashcroft remained at large, their safety was constantly under threat. Somehow, Marie felt that it was her responsibility to stop him. This was personal, of course. She wanted payback for what Ashcroft had done to her and her fellow team members. Part of her almost wanted him to make a move. She needed this whole Ashcroft thing to be over, to breathe freely, wake up in the morning knowing that he was not coming back, ever. Suddenly she knew that it was going to be down to her to finish it. Even if she had to use herself as bait to draw him out, she'd do it. Jackman was right. This time, they'd take him down.
"Marie?"
Jackman came over to her desk and sat down next to her.
"I've just been talking to a friend of mine at HQ. He's setting up a new unit that specializes in tracking and tracing the illegal movement of firearms and other weapons across the country. I've given him the details of Harcourt's missing guns, and he's going to let us know if he gets a whisper about them."
"Good. And Gary's checking out Harcourt's licenses for me, so..."
At that moment, a PC hurried into the CID room.
"Dear Jackman, sir. Sergeant said to tell you there's been a shooting."
"Where?"
barked Jackman, leaping to his feet.
"In the theatre car park down Ferry Lane, sir. Will you attend?"
"On our way."
Marie was already heading for the door.
"I'll grab a car. See you downstairs."
Jackman called across to Robbie.
"Go and tell the super that we're attending a shooting in Ferry Street, in the car park at the Salton Playhouse. I'll keep her updated from the scene."
Jackman knew the Playhouse well. In the past, he and his sister-in-law, Sarah, used to take his nephews to the pantomime there. It had been an après-Christmas ritual, one the kids were not alone in enjoying. He conjured up a picture of the car park in his head. Secluded, it was tucked around the back of the old Jacobean-style building with the walls of the theatre on two of its sides. Few people used it during the week, as it was somewhat out of the way and only catered for around 50 cars. He saw Marie waving to him from one of the pool vehicles, and he hurried over and jumped in. It would take only a few minutes to get there, and Marie had already activated the blue lights.
"Do you think we found the reason for Harcourt's guns being stolen, sir?" she asked, pulling fast into the main road.
"Bit of a coincidence if it's unrelated," he murmured. "I wonder just how serious it is."
"Grapevine says it's a fatality, sir. Unconfirmed, of course."
Jackman's heart sank. Knife crime was bad enough, but the thought of people using guns on the streets of Salton-le-Fen sickened him. As they arrived at the entrance to the lane that led down to the theatre, they saw a whole collection of emergency vehicles.
"Park it here and we'll go on foot."
Jackman released his seatbelt. The whole area was cordoned off, every inch of it flashing with blue lights. Jackman saw a black van and a team of armed officers pouring out of it.
"I see they've scrambled the ARV.
They hurried over to where uniform were manning the cordon.
"What have we got, Kevin?" Jackman asked.
PC Kevin Stoner lifted the blue and white tape for them to enter.
"I see one male, sir, probably early 20s, shot as he went to access his car. Key still in his hand, single shot to the head from long range. We are waiting for the medics to confirm life extinct, but from the look of the wound, he died instantly."
Any idea on him?
We haven't touched him, sir. We sealed the area immediately and have prohibited access until the photographer gets here.
He looked across to where the paramedics were about to leave the body. We do know that the vehicle is registered to a Christopher Keys of Baltimore Gardens, but I guess we don't know for sure that it's his car, do we?
Jackman nodded. The scene had to be protected from contamination, but as senior officer he needed to know who this young man was. He'd probably get a bollocking from the scene of crime guys, but he'd risk that. He took a protective suit from the pile close to where Kevin was standing and slipped on the necessary shoe covers and gloves.
You wait here, Marie. The fewer of us trampling the scene, the better. Not that I think there will be much in the way of incriminating evidence if he was shot from a distance.
Problem? She hadn't responded.
Christopher Keys, sir. He was one of the suspects in the hit and run where Kirsty Harcourt was killed, wasn't he?
Jackman let out a small groan.
I think you're right, Marie. Oh, hell.
And what if it's Harcourt's gun that killed him?
Marie said.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'll check the body first.
Jackman's head was racing. He didn't like the way this was shaping up at all. The paramedic gave a resigned shrug.
Already dead when we arrive, sir. We've verified life extinct. The shot entered his brain through his temple, exited through the back of his head.
Jackman approached the body. He had never seen Keys, so identifying him would be down to finding a driving license or credit card on his person. He stood for a moment staring down at the still form. The lad was pale and fair-haired and was wearing jeans, a t-shirt with a slogan on it, and a sleeveless hoodie. He could see the key fob clutched in his hand. There was very little blood from the entrance wound, just a neat hole in his right temple that had oozed a tiny scarlet rivulet that ran in a thin stream towards the young man's ear. Jackman couldn't see the exit wound because he was lying on his back, but he could see that the blood had pooled beneath his head. He could have been asleep. He didn't even look surprised. This young man hadn't seen death coming for him. Jackman knelt, said a few words that seemed appropriate, and felt in the pockets of the hoodie. He found what he was looking for almost at once. He opened the wallet and took out a driving license. Christopher Keys. Jackman let out a soft groan. This was going to be difficult and would have to be handled with extreme care. It could cause the Harcourt family a great deal of pain, unless, of course, Harcourt was behind it. He stood up. Time to call Superintendent Ruth Crook, and he wasn't looking forward to it. While Jackman made the call to Ruth Crook, Marie walked slowly around the perimeter of the crime scene, accompanied by Kevin Stoner.
"Was it you that found him, Kev?" she asked.
"Someone rep-